You're listening to AM 970, The Answer. And now, Reaching Out with Gregory Floyd, the president of Teamsters Local 237.
Welcome to another edition of Reaching Out. I'm Gregory Floyd, president, Local 237 Teamsters. With me, my very special guest is Robert Mahoney. He is a journalist and a fighter for press freedom. From 1997 to 2004, Mahoney worked for Reuters news agency around the world. He headed news bureaus in Jerusalem, West Africa, Germany, and also served as news editor for Europe, Africa, and the Middle East. Emergencies response team to address the growing safety needs of journalists. And I think more now than ever, your work is needed.
Absolutely. At the moment, we have a situation where journalists are being killed around the world in record numbers, thrown in jail for their work in record numbers, and abused and trolled and harassed online. This is because they are challenging power structures around the world in places as varied as Syria and Egypt or Venezuela at the moment. So journalists are on the front line.
Well, let's talk about Syria for a minute, because maybe more than a minute, because that's what brought us together, because we had a ceremony for Women's History Month last month, which was March, and Marie Colvin was an assassinated journalist, and she was assassinated in Syria, and she was also a member of Local 237. She started her career with Local 237 in 1978, and she went on to become this world-renowned journalist, war correspondent, and we honored her memory by giving a program and giving awards in her name. And that's how we met. Let's start with Syria, and let's talk about Marie, and then we'll talk about the journalists who are now being killed and threatened.
Sure. Well, I had the privilege of knowing Marie and working with her. When I was with Reuters, she was with the Sunday Times of London in the Middle East, particularly in Jerusalem. And her hallmark as a journalist was always to tell the stories of ordinary people, to go to the front lines, to find the people who were affected by wars, not the military people, not the politicians, but the ordinary citizens who bore the brunt of the conflict. That was her hallmark as a journalist and storyteller. And when the Arab uprisings occurred across the Middle East in 2011, she went to Libya, but then eventually she went to Syria. And it was there that she realized that as the Assad regime fought back for its life against the rebels, in the middle were ordinary Syrians who were being crushed, being bombed, shelled. And she wanted to tell their story. And despite all the advice from other journalists, she stayed. And she stuck it out in the city of Homs when nearly everyone else had left. And the Syrian government forces knew that journalists were there, and they eventually located, they pinpointed where it was, and they shelled it. And she was killed, along with a French photographer and a number of other people were injured. So she paid the ultimate price for what she always called bearing witness, being there, because she felt, if not us, who? And if not now, when? That's why she did these things.
Now, there's a book about her life story, and a movie was made about her life story. It just recently released.
Yeah, the biography was written by a British journalist, Lindsay Hilsum of Channel 4 News, who is a well-known TV correspondent, and she was Marie's friend. She wrote this book, which takes from Marie's very early days as a child in Oyster Bay, New York. She talks about her time at the Teamsters in New York.
Yes.
City, and about the stories that Marie did and how proud she was to be a Teamster and sew the badge on her jacket. So, yeah, that book also shows that the era of journalists like Marie is in many ways over. because there are very few print journalists left who can find an organization that will give them the money and the possibility to do that kind of reporting, to go to places and stay for weeks without necessarily filing a story. Now the pressures on journalists, the financial pressures on news organizations are much bigger. So I think Marie was the last of a generation of those kinds of correspondents. And then based on the book, the biography by Lindsay Hilsum, Matthew Heineman, whom I know is a documentary filmmaker and a producer, has made this film of Marie. It's a very good film, but it focuses only on one part of her very long life, which was the time that she was in Homs in Syria. And that was really the last few years of her life. I mean, before that, she had a track record as a great frontline reporter who had worked in the Middle East, North Africa, who had worked in Asia, and also in Sri Lanka, which covering the civil war there, she was hit by shrapnel and lost one of her eyes. So she became famous later on as the woman journalist with the black eye patch. She used to joke that she looked like a pirate. And then when she would go out to a fancy, one of those very fancy receptions where she would be honored, she had a rhinestone eye patch for uh-huh. special occasions. She had a great sense of humor.
It sounds like a wonderful person. You mentioned journalists being killed now. Do you have the names of a few journalists who were killed now and the circumstances in which they were killed?
Definitely. I mean, the Committee to Protect Journalists, which I work for, it documents every attack on a journalist, whether it's murder or whether it's a physical assault or jailing. And each one of those journalists is on our website, cpj.org, because it is really important that governments and other violators of journalists do not get away with it and do not operate in the dark. So one of the missions that we as journalists have to protect our fellow journalists is to make sure that every assault, every attack is documented and that there is evidence is gathered. We're not lawyers, we're journalists, but nobody's sacrifice goes unrecognized. So, I mean, if your listeners, watch the TV news or read a newspaper, they're going to have heard of some of these journalists, I think. The most recent high-profile journalist killing was of the Saudi journalist, Jamal Khashoggi.
Yes.
He was a Washington Post columnist and very prominent journalist. He spoke fluent English, and he was well known amongst journalists for many years who covered the Middle East because he was one of the few Saudi journalists who would actually talk to foreigners. And he knew what he was talking about because before he became a full-time journalist, he actually worked in the Saudi government as an aide and press spokesman to some very high-profile people, including the Saudi ambassador to Washington, D.C., and to London. So he knew what he was talking about. And that's what really got under the skin of the Saudi royal family, because he was credible and he had details. And so he used to write these columns for the Washington Post, pointing out what was going wrong in Saudi Arabia, pointing out the corruption and the hypocrisy, and also cautioning people that Mohammed bin Salman, the son of the king, who is slowly becoming more and more powerful, although he portrays himself in the West as a reformer, he nevertheless has the same monarchical and autocratic tendencies that some of his predecessors have. So Jamal was living in exile for much of the time, living in D.C. He was a U.S. permanent resident, a green card holder, in other words. And he needed a document that from the Saudi authorities to show that his divorce of his Saudi wife had gone through, because in the meantime, he had met a Turkish woman that he wanted to marry. So Jamal and his fiancée go to the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in Turkey to pick up this paper, a routine thing, just like anybody needs a piece of paper to show that they're free to marry. And she waited outside, and he went in, and he never came out. And what happened inside that consulate, we got to know about it very slowly, little bits of information were leaked out by the Turks, but it was horrific. He was basically grabbed by a hit squad that had flown in from Saudi Arabia, apparently originally to take him back, but they ended up killing him. We think they strangled him, and then this is pretty gruesome. They cut him up. They cut the body up, and the body's never been found. So they butchered him. There were denials from the Saudi government, but eventually they kind of acknowledged, yes, he had died inside the consulate. And a number of Saudis have been put on trial back in Saudi Arabia, but they're not the people that ordered or masterminded this crime, so there's no justice for him.
Who ordered the crime?
Well, we don't know for certain, but look, the way things work in Saudi Arabia is that something like this would come from the very top. This wouldn't be, you know, some civil servant running off and doing a murder on the side for his boss without telling him. So we believe it goes right to the top, and so does everyone else. The problem is that we'll probably never know the truth because we will never get a full investigation. There is no body. It's inside a diplomatic mission in a foreign country, and all trails lead back to Saudi Arabia, which, as we all know, is an absolute monarchy. And it's very, very difficult to get justice in this case. But the murder of Jamal Khashoggi was so outrageous and so brazen that it's motivated people around the world to stand up for justice. So he has become a kind of a poster for some of the dangers and threats that journalists face when they stand up and speak truth to power.
Now, there was some talk that there may have been some tapes, some recordings of this, and perhaps one day those recordings will be released.
Apparently, the Turks have got the Turkish Secret Service have got monitoring the diplomatic mission there in Istanbul, and they have audio of what happened. You can apparently hear his voice, and you can hear the scuffles, the screams, and the rest of it. We have not heard that. I imagine, and I don't know, but I imagine the CIA also has access to this kind of material because they cooperate on an intelligence level with the Turks. So yeah, that material we believe is out there, and maybe one day it will be revealed to us. But at the moment, everyone is working on the assumption that this goes right to the highest levels of the Saudi government.
You're listening to Reaching Out. I'm Gregory Floyd, President, Local 237 Teamsters. With me, my very special guest, Robert Mahoney, who is a journalist and fighter for press freedom. And there's also another twist that developed in the story. The owner of the Washington Post, Jeff Bezos, his information was hacked, and they believe it was the Saudi government?
Yeah, the story is that that the Saudis got a third party to try to hack into his personal information, his phone, because he owns the Washington Post. And there's a pattern here because he isn't the first person. He's very high profile. He's the richest man in the world, and he owns the Washington Post, for which Jamal Khashoggi worked. But we have been following at the Committee to Protect Journalists the trail of Saudis commissioning others to monitor people who knew Jamal Khashoggi or who had interactions with him. And there was a Saudi exile in Canada that we know for a fact now. His phone was hacked by a company. It's an Israeli-based company that provides spyware and monitoring equipment, which it says it sells only to governments. But we believe that there's evidence on the devices of this Saudi exile in Canada to show that his conversations with Jamal Khashoggi were being monitored. So Jamal was on the radar of the Saudi government for a long time before this happened. He was really a thorn in their flesh.
So who are some of the other journalists who have been killed and threatened?
Oh, there are so many. I mean, right here on our doorstep,
yes,
in the U.S., we have the murder of journalists routinely in Mexico who are covering organized crime, drug trafficking, people like Javier Valdez, who was someone that the Committee to Protect Journalists had honored. He was shot dead in the street because he covered those criminal gangs. Mexico is a really dangerous place for any investigative journalist because there are so few protections. There's endemic corruption. The local law enforcement is often in the pocket of the drug cartels, who are extremely powerful, wealthy, and violent. So there are very few independent journalists who dare risk their lives by reporting on organized crime. In the last 18 months or so, we had two murders of journalists in Western Europe, which is very, very rare. On the island of Malta in the Mediterranean, Malta is a member of the European Union. A very courageous woman called Daphne Caruana Galizia was blown up in her car. They placed a bomb under the seat of her car, and as she drove off, they exploded it because she had been investigating organized crime in Malta. Malta is a country where, you know, a lot of money comes in and is laundered and goes back out, apparently. And she had been looking at a passport scam for people to buy EU passports. Still, no justice in that murder. And then shortly after that, there was a very young guy in his late 20s called Jan Kuciak, who was working in Slovakia, in Eastern Europe. And he was looking at the links between the Slovak government, and that's a country that's a member of the European Union, and an Italian mafia called the 'Ndrangheta, which, again, had been laundering money, using the facade of a government to do criminal activity. And he was shot in the head alongside his girlfriend on the sofa in their apartment just last year. So these are journalists who are murdered. These are not journalists who are in the wrong place at the wrong time, or who go to a war zone, step on a landmine, or just happen to get caught in crossfire. These journalists, and there are so many of them, are deliberately targeted either by governments or by criminal gangs or militias because of the work that they're doing. It's just a form of shutting them up, of getting them out of the story. Because, you know, I mean, there are all kinds of censorship, but murder is really the ultimate form of censorship. And we see it more and more often in more and more countries.
So your organization to protect journalists, what is it actually doing? I don't want to sound facetious, but if I'm a journalist, I'm listening to this message, and you have this organization. What is it that you're actually doing, and what can you do, and what can we do better?
Okay, let me just give you a very brief background. This was an organization that was set up back in 1981, so it's been around for 37 years or so, by journalists who were concerned that no one was doing anything for journalists in developing countries at the time who had no protections. And so they started just very simply highlighting the cases of those journalists by writing letters to the president of the country or the chief of police or whatever it was, whoever it was who was harassing or otherwise attacking those journalists. And they managed to convince a number of high-profile U.S. journalists at the time to put their names on the letterhead so they got Walter Cronkite, for example. And the founders of the organization that I now work for say it was the power of the letterhead that really made a difference. Like, if you're the president of, in the first case they had, I think it was someone from Paraguay. You're the president of Paraguay, you get a letter from New York from, you know, someone who is a journalistic institution in the United States, plus a number of other prominent journalists. You sit up and take notice. So that worked for a while. And then we realized that in order to advocate for journalists, we needed to be able to speak from a position of authority, that we had the evidence, we'd done our homework, and we had the documentation. So that's what we do. We function like a news agency, but we focus on a narrow area of attacks on journalists and press freedom violations. Then with that information that we gather, we go to countries. We go. I've met presidents and prime ministers. They'll often meet you, and you give them the evidence. You say, your government's doing this, doing that, and you can name or shame. You can sometimes persuade. We work with other groups, too. It's kind of, we use, moral authority, moral force, persuasion, and calling people out. And just making it impossible for people to get away with crimes, because that's the easiest. If no one speaks out when a journalist is killed or thrown in jail, that sends a very, that sends a terrible message to the dictator or the government that, hey, nobody cares about this guy. Maybe no one will right. care about the next guy that okay. I throw in. And, you know, evil thrives in darkness. And so we just try to shine a light on it. So that's what we do. And we also provide practical information and help to journalists, point them in the direction where they can get the resources or knowledge to better protect themselves. And we also provide financial and other assistance to the families of journalists that are jailed. We sometimes pay medical bills for journalists that have been, you know, badly beaten up and they can't afford the medical treatment. So we try to provide practical help as well as what I would say, like the moral advocacy is to try to prevent more attacks.
Now, who are some of the journalists that are jailed now and what circumstances were they jailed under?
Well, I mean, we have the biggest jailers of journalists around the world, the kind of top 10 list of bad ones, on the top yes, three are Turkey sure. and China and Egypt. Those are the top three, and they account for most of the, you know, the journalists, more than 250 at our last count, that are in jail around the world. Turkey, you've got President Erdogan, who has essentially closed down most opposition. His friends, his cronies, or his relatives own most of the big conglomerates and companies that own media groups. So there is no real strong opposition narrative on the media. And if you do cross a line, you go to jail. So there's nearly 70 journalists in jail in Turkey. And that often surprises people because, you know, Turkey is a developing country. It's a member of NATO and it wanted to join the EU. It's not like it's North Korea, but it's the biggest jailer of journalists in the world. And then China. I mean, in China, there is really very little independent media. You cannot report anything on Tiananmen Square, the massacre back in the late 90s of protesters. You can't write about Tibet, and you can't write about corruption inside the president's family and main circles without being called in. And if you continue and ignore the warnings that you get, then you will be jailed. And there are people that jail for a very long time. They just disappear into the penal system in China for years and years and even decades. And on it goes. I mean, Egypt is a prime example of a country that's gone backwards very fast. Before the Arab Spring, back in 2011, under President Mubarak, there were no journalists in jail in Egypt, not one. Because journalists, and this is unfortunate but necessary, they censored themselves. They knew where, as they say there, they knew where the red lines were. So you could walk up to that red line, but you never crossed it, and you stayed free. But after the fall of Mubarak and the coming to power, basically, of the military, they won't tolerate any opposition. And you get picked up and you're in jail for years on end. So there's 25 journalists in jail in Egypt. And Egypt is a big ally of the U.S. Sisi is here in the U.S. just this month meeting Trump. But, you know, I don't expect that our president will stand up for the journalists that are in jail in his meetings with President Sisi.
Unbelievable. Well, how do journalists get involved in your organization? We have about 45 seconds.
Go to our website and you can sign up for our newsletters. You can send us tips if you know of a journalist that's in trouble, whether it's in the United States or whether it's you know, somewhere overseas. It doesn't matter. We want to hear from you. You can make a donation to the organization. We're a nonprofit. We don't accept any government money so that we can criticize everybody equally and fairly. The thing to do is if you're a journalist and you hear of an arrest or a subpoena, let us know and we'll follow up.
Thank you. I'm Gregory Floyd, president of Local 237 Teamsters. You've been listening to Reaching Out. My very special guest, Robert Mahoney, journalist and fighter for press freedom. Thank you very much for coming on Reaching Out.
It's been great. Thank you so much for giving us the time. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Reaching Out with Gregory Floyd, president of Teamsters Local 237. Join us each and every Saturday night at 7, right here on AM 970, The Answer.